Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Capitol Record. I hope that you, like me, have enjoyed these conversations we've been having lately. The last few weeks, we've just gotten wonderful feedback. We had Sam Rhines come really give us the down low on the state of the U.S. energy sector last week. We had Andy Puzder week before just really bring in the heat as it pertains to so many subjects that matter in the contemporary environment and our need to be defending free enterprise in this country that is so largely built off of free enterprise. And so right now, one of the big topics that is, I guess, a huge threat to that cause and to that ongoing forward progress is the sort of wokest religion that is found as one of its sacraments, policies of what they call diversity, equity, and inclusion. And the private sector is now embracing DEI in record numbers. And whether we're talking about ESG, whether we're talking about just the broader tenets of the woke ideology, there is no way to talk about a modern defense of free enterprise and a modern defense of capital markets without talking about the modern threat that is DEI. And so I found Kenan Spivak from, he sat with me at a recent National Review event, but Kenan is the founder and chairman of SMI Group. He is a multi-decade, well-known investment banker and currently serves as the chairman of his own firm, having spent many years as an investment banker at Merrill Lynch and in direct C-suite positions with Fortune 500 companies. His pedigree resume speaks for itself. He's a graduate of Columbia Law School, MBA from Columbia, and not only, though, a very accomplished businessman, legal and corporate expert, but also a very well-read thinker. And that's why I want Kenan to come on today, is because I think these efforts around DEI, you're going to hear more and more about it. But Kenan is uniquely qualified not only to talk about the tactics that we want to use to fight against this stuff, but to talk about what the real cost is, to talk about the cost in human capital and what that does to our productivity as a nation. And a country like ours that generates its productivity out of the private sector, seeing the private sector fall into some of these traps is very concerning. And Kenan is someone who's become a great expert in what we can do to try to stop this damage. So I'm going to bring Kenan on now. We're going to have a conversation about the modern threat to free enterprise that is DEI. So with that said, welcome to yet another Capitol Record podcast and yet another first-time guest here in 2022. We're on a roll of continuing to bring new people onto Capitol Record. And Kenan, you are our guest here this week on Capitol Record. Welcome.
Thank you, David. And when I look at who your guests have been, I'm very honored to join that list.
Well, I really enjoyed a conversation you and I had together at a National Review event a number of weeks back, but since then I've read quite a bit of the things that you have written, and it sounds as if some of the things that you've committed not only a lot of your career to, but even right now, this stage of life, a lot of your writing and ideological pursuits are really in line with what the mission of National Review's Capitol Record is. I want to focus on one particular thing, and I imagine it'll take us in a number of different directions. But in your career, in investment banking, in you know, corporate finance, it does seem to me that versus the decades in which you were enjoying a successful career in corporate America, that right now, this stage of diversity requirements in corporate America and this obsession with so-called equity and inclusion represents a total changing of the guard compared to what you worked in for much of your career. And I'd love for you to share with our listeners what you think about the landscape of corporate America around this so-called DEI agenda.
You are right that the corporate agenda is radically different and is moving in a very unfortunate direction. To put it into a bit of perspective, when I was in college, which was in the 1970s, affirmative action was already widely in place at the university level. I applied to college in the same year in which Alan Bakke appealed to the Supreme Court what became the landmark case in university affirmative action, Bakke versus the Regents of the State University of California. For many years, affirmative action, which is less invasive than DEI, for many years, affirmative action was a development within the university system, and I think a very, very bad one. And contrary to what the Supreme Court determined on a very narrow decision, I think one which violated the precepts on which our nation was founded, not to mention the 14th Amendment. We can talk about that if you'd like to, but let's move to the finance arena and the corporate arena. During my heyday of investment banking in the 1980s and 90s, although I own an investment bank today, then I was with Merrill Lynch, and so by definition, that was a larger platform. There was no such thing as affirmative action or diversity, equity, and inclusion in general corporate America, with one exception. There was a requirement for affirmative action by contractors for the federal government, and that has its antecedents back in the 1960s. The first executive order requiring affirmative action was one that President Kennedy promulgated, though the more famous executive order is one that President Johnson promulgated. And it, for the first time, started us down the path of affirmative action, meaning other than taking steps to make certain your company does not discriminate against minorities because of their race. And it's not until much more recently that affirmative action meant taking steps to discriminate affirmatively because of someone's race. Moving beyond, although we should go back and look
at... Let me intervene with a question, and I'm playing devil's advocate. It's almost going to be hard for me to even get this fake question out of my mouth, but I think it's a fair one. What if someone were to say, okay, you're referring to the 80s and 90s where there wasn't this basically codified discrimination based on hiring someone because of race. Yet there are some who would look at the data of that period and will use your industry of investment banking and say that there was such an incredible lack of representation of minorities and women that maybe the Wall Street refused to self-diversify or meritocratically diversify. And so some of these stipulations were brought on because of the very period of time you're talking about. What would you say to that?
I would make both a business and a legal comment. Title VII, the Civil Rights Act, expressly prohibits the use of an imbalance in racial or gender percentages as the basis for finding discrimination. Title VII required that there be a showing that the defendant had taken affirmative steps, affirmative being used in a different context here, to discriminate, and did so for the intention and purpose of holding down whatever group it was alleged to have discriminated against. Title VII expressly states that even if there's an imbalance, even if that imbalance can be found to possibly be avoidable, that no liability can be imposed on a company because of that imbalance. That's interestingly, to skip ahead, though I will answer your question, the exact opposite of the Biden executive orders, which hold that an imbalance of percent is per se a finding of discrimination, and that steps have to be taken to remedy that imbalance, even if there is no discrimination. Turning back to the 80s and 90s, before that was the law, but even then, as lawsuits were commenced making that argument, my answer is very simple. The pool from which the elite investment banks were recruiting was overwhelmingly not Black, overwhelmingly not Hispanic, overwhelmingly not female. Even today, and this percent hasn't changed much, the United States is only 12 to 13% Black. It's obviously a little more than 50% women. In the 1980s and 90s, the percentage of Black graduates of leading business schools was very small, even with affirmative action. The percentage of female graduates was about 25%. There is a problem in this nation, but the problem starts in K through 12 education. And the problem is that the pool by which we should be measuring who is in any of these positions, whether it's investment banking in 1990 or investment banking in 2022, is not the percent of Blacks or Hispanics or Asians in the society. It's the percent who are qualified based on the criteria that I think are quite properly used to decide who should get those jobs. And even that criteria is now askew because of 40 or 50 years of affirmative action, which means that a resume that says that someone's the graduate of a particular school or had a particular job no longer means what it once meant. And that's a very difficult concept for a lot of people who advocate DEI and affirmative action to accept. But the fact that someone has a resume that said they went to an Ivy League college and an Ivy League business school and then got a job at Goldman Sachs doesn't mean what it would have meant 30 years ago, and not to go on too long. If 40 or 50 years ago, a Black person had that resume, that person clearly overcame intense discrimination, intense odds. And I'd look at that person and say he or she was probably five times better than the average white person with similar resume and similar background. But in 2022, there's a lot of uncertainty what each of these degrees means because of 40 or 50 years of affirmative action.
So it sounds as if there is a necessary connectivity between academic affirmative action and racial-based policies, and then where one would go to assess corporate America's data and policy framework, and that what you're saying is out of the affirmative action at the university level has become the well that you and I would argue is poisoned in terms of assessing diversity practices in corporate America today, that one beget the other.
Yes, but the reasons and the nature of DEI today is different from affirmative action. So let me take a step back. Traditionally, and I don't mean in the 1960s in the Kennedy version of affirmative action, which really just meant take concrete steps to avoid discrimination. And I want to make very clear that I am firmly opposed to discriminating against anyone on the basis of their race, their ethnicity, their national origin, except for national security situations. And my opposition to DEI is born of that set of views, not a set of views that we should be discriminating. But leave aside the Kennedy era affirmative action. Affirmative action was the use initially of outreach and recruitment to make sure that minorities knew that there was a welcome place for them. I actually favor that. Then affirmative action became the use of a so-called holistic admissions program that tried to look at obstacles people may have overcome and that therefore their academic performance or future career performance might be better than what it appeared based on their earlier grades or earlier performance. They had to have a job after school, so they weren't building Habitat for the Humanity houses. Okay. I favor that type of affirmative action as well and believe that it is well-intentioned and not racially biased. Then affirmative action became the adjustment of grades, the creation of separate pools, the addition, as the University of Michigan did, of 20 points to each applicant's score. That's the type of affirmative action that was at issue in the Bakke case. And that's the type of affirmative action which, in a unusual combination of concurring opinions, the Supreme Court allowed, though it ordered the plaintiff be admitted to medical school because it found that particular affirmative action program had gone too far. And that's what people forget. The plaintiff actually won that case. That court held, and every court that's considered affirmative action in the university environment has held, the quotas are impermissible. In a pair of decisions involving the University of Michigan some 20 years ago, which really created the current basis for university affirmative action, the court again held that quotas were impermissible, that rigid addition of points and rigid pools were impermissible. But then, in what I consider doublespeak gobbledygook, it found that soft discrimination, where the university couldn't really write down the rules it was following, but it knew discrimination when it saw it, and as long as it employed this soft discrimination that didn't have real formulas, that somehow was okay. Lack of transparency was okay. Lack of specificity and consistency was okay. It just wasn't okay if you admitted what you were doing. And under that version of affirmative action, blacks and Hispanics and women, but most particularly blacks, were admitted with materially lower academic performance to college. And I want to make one last point, and then I won't keep talking. Many of the blacks, to a lesser degree Hispanics, admitted under affirmative action are not poor. They did not necessarily go to schools in bad neighborhoods. Many of them went to private schools. Many of them had the benefit of an advantaged childhood with parents who were already college graduates, if not doctors and lawyers. Interestingly, in a case now pending before the Supreme Court, Harvard filed a brief in which it admitted that it opposed affirmative action targeting the impoverished because it didn't want to have to admit all those poor people and pay for them.
So I mentioned in the introduction that you both did business school, grad school, and law school at Columbia, and have spent your career as a practicing attorney, and yet also a course in corporate America, operator, a financier. So you have your toe in both the legal waters and the business operations waters, and I'm hearing a lot about the legality side and the legal problems with the affirmative action framework, the legal challenges that ought to exist to a quota-based administration of attempted anti-discrimination. And yet, I guess I want to ask you, in practice, outside of some of the legal arguments that I think you're wise to make because I think they're impenetrable, operationally, Do you believe there was a discrimination problem in corporate America in the 80s and 90s? You were in the gaming industry, you were in Wall Street, you were in entertainment, you saw Hollywood, you saw New York. These are pillars of culture. You had a pretty good seat to a lot of this. Did you see otherwise qualified African-Americans and Hispanics not getting jobs because of their race? And the reason I'm asking is I'm not just looking to critique the way in which we're trying to remedy it. I want to better unpack what we're trying to remedy. You know, was there a systemic problem of people being denied job opportunities that were otherwise qualified? And I think your experience here would be useful, even aside from the legal commentary that is obviously ultimately quite pertinent.
Right. You make a good point. And interestingly, my legal commentary here is because that's the best way of stopping what's happening. My career overwhelmingly has not been in the practice of law. It's about 4 or 5 years of my career. It has been as a business executive and an investment banker. But we do need to stop this DEI and affirmative action for moral reasons, but also business reasons. And the legal avenue may be the way to success there. In the 80s and 90s, as you said, I was largely involved in the entertainment industry, gaming industries. In those industries, I don't think there was widespread discrimination. Those industries early on provided opportunities to blacks, to women. There were many, many blacks, many, many women. The music industry, which is part of the entertainment industry, more so maybe than in movie and television. But there were quite a few opportunities. Keep in mind that the entertainment industry in the early 1900s grew by providing opportunities to immigrant Jews, who at that time had been the object of a lot of discrimination in America, including in the financial industry. So there's a history in the American entertainment industry of being open to people of all races and backgrounds. And I think it's also important that as late as the 80s and 90s, there probably was a disproportionate number of Jews involved in those industries, who had a very long record of co-founding the NAACP, of working to end discrimination. So I don't think there was a lot in those industries, but there's a but coming. I was also active, as you point out, in investment banking, and that gave me a broader view into American business, not just on the coasts. And I do think there was discrimination, and I do think it was widespread. And I do think that to some degree, people in companies would have typified it as hiring their friends, the people they knew from their church, the people they knew from their community, and maybe they didn't even think that what they were doing was discriminatory. I don't agree. I think that as late as the 80s and 90s, two equally qualified people, one black, one white, in many industries, the white person would have an advantage. And I think that was very unfortunate and completely wrong.
And yet you would be opposed to a quotas-based mandate, state-intervened affirmative action program as a means of trying to rectify that. And so what do you think would be a good market solution to the dynamic you described that you would observe from time to time?
Well, first, I think people are people. I don't think people are white, black, Hispanic. They're people. The fact that, sadly, in 1986, Mr. X was discriminated against isn't made right because in 2022, Mr. Y or Ms. Z is now discriminated against or for. These are two different people. And what's so wrong with what's happening today, more so than what was happening in universities in the 1970s or 80s, is that people are being viewed first and foremost as members of their race and their gender identity, not even their gender, and only secondly as individuals. DEI, much more so than affirmative action, is about viewing people first and foremost as members of groups. And so, in part, nothing we do today to help Ms. X or Mr. X will make up for what was done to some other person in 1986. Instead, what we have to do is make sure it doesn't happen again, whether to white people, black people, or orange people. Now, if the argument is that because of discrimination in the 1980s, the children of those people discriminated against, or even those people in 2022, because they may still be in their 50s or 60s, have had less of a career or less of a career opportunity, and therefore they can't perform as well and can't get another job, I do have to make the business observation that sadly, that's still not a reason to harm someone who had nothing to do with that discrimination, hire someone who will do a less good job to make up for what may have happened 20, 30, 40 years ago. What it tells us, though, is that we have to do everything we can, starting with K through 12, to reduce, if we can, eliminate disparities in educational opportunity so that people have an equal shot.
You know, this fascinates me because it does seem that some of the people who are most zealous about DEI are most opposed to school choice. And it sounds to me like you've laid out that one of the great predicates to better opportunity in the workforce is greater school opportunity and greater school choice that can drive a superior educational outcome for men and women of all races. So why would someone be zealous about DEI and opposed to a policy solution that just indisputably helps even the playing field among races?
I'm going to give you two answers. One, where the people in favor of DEI mean elected Democrat officials, they're beholden to the two major K through 12 teacher unions, the NEA and the AFT. And they're not making
well, and
the
I
decision.
Should point out NEA and AFT are the two big federal teacher unions. God forbid we actually talk about California Teachers Association and New York teachers. You get into the state unions and it just explodes even further. Yeah.
By the way, the AFT has just won a contract where it's affiliating with the Community College Professors Union in the state of California. So the Community College Professors are now a local of the AFT. It's not good. But those Democrat elected officials may not believe what they're saying. They believe what they're saying because they need to say it to get contributions. But there are other people who are not Democrat elected officials who probably do believe what they're saying. And I don't think they're thinking it through very well. They're not seeing that charter schools and religious schools benefit minorities throughout America by providing committed administrations and committed teachers and alternative programs that are helping students who maybe don't fit as well in their local public school get the kind of education that they want. They're too fixated on the elite private schools. Oddly, or bizarrely, the elite public schools today are among the most active in affirmative action. It's not really DEI at that level, but it's affirmative action. And the accreditation rules in the private K through 12 schools require affirmative action and prohibit the service as a trustee of anyone who opposes affirmative action.
So there's some strong arm tactics going on. There's some Alinsky-like behavior. They must feel very strongly about the issue. And I bet some of them believe that they're doing it because they're trying to right a wrong. you have a legal argument against what they're doing, but you also have a moral argument that they're not actually satisfying an injustice from 1986 by creating a second injustice in 2022. But let's talk about the business ramifications, the ethics, the motives, the intent, all of these things out there. And I think a lot of it, I suspect you'd agree, is politicking and virtue signaling and sort of pharisaical quasi-religious behavior. But what would be the end run here for corporate America? Do we end up with a suboptimal productive workforce, or do we end up with a dysfunctional one, or do we end up with one that just does pretty darn well anyways and actually comes out of it a little bit more diverse racially, and so no harm, no foul? What are you afraid of here, Kenan?
Yeah, I don't think it's the last. U.S. competitiveness has to decline when its most important asset, which is human capital, is of less quality, less well-trained, less experienced, less well-motivated, afraid. There's also the intermingling of cancel culture and the fear that people have of what they say. There's this giant industry today in the United States, a $4 billion industry today of DEI training and DEI consultants. And that's $4 billion that is coming right out of any other spending that may be good for our corporations. But more importantly, a lot of that is devoted to training that says to an employee, keep your mouth shut. Don't fire people if they're of the wrong background, even if they're not doing their work well. Hire people if they're of the preferred background, even if they wouldn't do the work well. And your personal progress will be judged by that, which is what many corporations today are doing.
So let's actually start with the first point you made on the $4 billion. Before we go to the indoctrination, before we go to the exacerbation of cancel culture and the sort of cultural Marxist behavior that takes place, economically alone, is $4 billion a year in DEI BS a substantive amount of capital misallocation? What else could be done with that money if it were not going into feeding this black hole of inefficiency, bureaucracy, Phariseeism, and so forth? Could companies hire more people? Could they invest in new projects? If you say it's a couple hundred grand, then no one cares. $4 billion, and you put a multiplier effect on what could be done with that money, you're talking real economic productivity. And I suspect the $4 billion's hard cost doesn't include sort of, harder to trace soft dollars and soft expense that really comes out of this whole cottage industry. Am I overthinking the economic impact?
No, except I would say that $4 billion, to be fair, compared to the total GDP in the United States, is not material. But what $4 billion is, and you are right, is simply a hard cost number for training and consultants. It's not the cost of all of the meetings and planning and the things not done and the things done because of the $4 billion.
Well, back to the legal side. $4 billion does not include legal settlements. It doesn't include class actions. It doesn't include legal bills. It doesn't include severance payments. So that's what I'm referring to. When we talk about the $4 billion for training manuals, and a couple webinars, it's more meant to be, you're right, divided by GDP, it's not a significant amount. But the dollars that some companies are spending, when you consider the vast array of the DEI ecosystem, I think then you're talking about really substantial money.
You're right, but I think the even more substantial money is the loss of productivity. It takes a very small loss of productivity that compounds every year to make a very large difference. And if I just look at the companies I'm involved with and my colleagues at other companies and at their tales of woe, it's become very, very difficult to hire, promote, and fire based primarily on merit. The DEI overlay comes first. Within the DEI overlay, let's assume the company particularly wants disabled black females. The company's going to seek the most qualified disabled black female, but it's still limited in that example to disabled black females. Where this is very, very difficult, and I hadn't made the point yet clearly in our discussion, is the difference between DEI, particularly the EV equity and affirmative action, is that the intention of equity is that the workforce precisely reflect the community. To precisely reflect the community, and in the view of many of the proponents, they don't mean the pool based on degrees or experience. They literally mean just looking at the U.S. population. So if the U.S. population is 12.7% black, they mean at least 12.7% black. If it's 18% Hispanic, they mean 18% Hispanic. Because the pools of qualified applicants in many, many industries are orders of magnitude less than that, even after affirmative action, bringing people in at anywhere near that level requires hiring people who lack experience, lack the capability, lack the judgment to do many jobs, as well as the people who would have had those jobs had the DEI people not been hired or promoted. And it's a very, very serious problem. Unless you're of the view, which I'm not, that all people are equally qualified to do everything and that there are no differences among people, this is a serious problem.
So the productivity hit, for those of us who value economics as the study of human action, the productivity as what really drives growth, quality of life, the aim of human flourishing that is the aim of this podcast, that what you're hitting on is a big deal, because anything that is counter-productivity is counter-sound economics and public policy. But I also wonder if there is an uneven distribution of the impact, because it would seem to me that much like the criticism of the greater regulatory state and the realities of, let's say, tax compliance, that Exxon and Chevron in energy and Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan on Wall Street and Google and Facebook and Silicon Valley, that's a heavy cost for DEI and it hits them productivity, but they have the resources to absorb the additional cost better than startups, better than family businesses, better than small business. And I wonder if as DEI grows its tentacles, not just in the parasitic way it hurts productivity at big companies, but the way that its impact will come downstream, that we will end up hurting smaller businesses more than bigger businesses for the same kind of logic that we make the criticism around regulation and tax compliance.
Maybe I'd have a very slightly different perspective. I think we'll hurt them equally, but they will be unable to withstand the harm because, as you point out rightly, the very large corporations have enough profit, enough resources that if they were to perform less well, they're not going to disappear. For startups, the same percentage harm may be the difference between survival and not surviving.
So it's more harm then. I mean, it's somewhat semantics, but that equals more harm.
Yeah. I'm just saying you get to the more harm because they can't absorb the harm. Can I go back for a second to education, only because DEI is so much more advanced there. And I want to make a point by analogy. The proponents of DEI oppose testing. The SAT, for example, has been discontinued by a lot of schools because of the argument that blacks didn't do as well. If you eliminate the test, then they don't not do as well. There's simply no test and no ability to observe the data it provides. The proponents of DEI have argued that math is racist, that having to get the correct answer on math is racist. The largest state in the United States, California, is considering wholesale changes to its math curriculum to eliminate, in many ways, having to get the answer right, eliminate gifted programs because proponents of DEI argue those are unfair to those who can't be in gifted programs, and to eliminate the focus in math on advanced math like algebra and calculus. It appears that California ultimately may pull back from the abyss and only make some changes to its curriculum, but the fact that it's considering them is notable. In Oregon, grade point averages were eliminated as a requirement for graduation for much the same reason. When we eliminate measuring differences, we can't observe differences. It doesn't make the differences go away. If we eliminate gifted classes and calculus and algebra, in fact, fewer people will learn calculus and algebra, and fewer people will be able to make contributions to the sciences. As corporations, in order to adopt DEI programs, which particularly federal contractors are being required to do by the Biden administration, they may find it easier to eliminate those tools that allow them to assess differences, because it may be easier to not know what they don't want to know. So I do think we are looking over a period of years, if what's now happening persists, of watering down our ability to measure differences, of watering down our willingness to consider differences. And going back to your previous question, that has to reduce American competitiveness and has to reduce what's really been one of the main engines of American competitiveness, which is our capital formation in startups. We have far more startups than anywhere else in the world. And most of today's large companies outside of the energy sector were not so long ago startups. It's a very unfortunate future ahead of us, unless through a combination of the business failures of these companies and the legal path, a lot of what's happening now is reversed.
And so the legal path you mentioned as a tactic towards being able to kind of stop the bleeding to some degree. I've been having more and more conversations, Kenan, with CEOs and business leaders where I'm suggesting that I don't see an end to this without someone playing the role of martyr, that some high-profile CEO has to fall on a sword and then survive it, where it can be a model to other corporate leaders that, okay, I am actually allowed to speak out against insanity. There is right now enough self-preservation objective, which is understandable, but I almost feel like there needs to be someone who's willing to go quote unquote take one for the team, survive it, and then serve as a model to at least reverse the momentum, to try to kind of see a pendulum shift here. Do you have any hope that we can gain some benefit just from the moral and courageous moxie of business leaders and titans, or do you only see hope at a courthouse?
I don't see a lot of hope from hired CEOs, even CEOs who were founders of their companies in the last year or two have lost their companies over taking positions that were contrary to woke dogma. I just can't see a CEO who serves at the pleasure of the board of directors, who are elected by shareholders, being willing to step up right now. Maybe some of the billionaire CEOs, Elon Musk comes to mind as someone who does seem willing to speak up. Some of those people, perhaps. Hired CEOs, I don't think so much as I wish that they could. The opposition that they suffer both from employees internally and from markets in businesses that have advertisers, advertiser boycotts. We saw a little bit of standing up at Spotify after the Joe Rogan episode. We saw a little bit of standing up at Netflix. Not a lot, but a little. Maybe we'll see some more of that. I'm a little more optimistic about the legal route because, at least in my judgment, our 14th Amendment, federal law, and most court precedent is squarely on the side of stopping a lot of what's happening in DEI. We've seen some good court decisions on Biden's efforts in loan programs for minority farmers. I think we'll have a good decision from the Supreme Court on this SFFA case against Harvard and University of North Carolina. And not so therefore, not because I went to law school, but because I think that judges and lawyers are not beholden to the same pressures as corporate CEOs. I think that a lot of the effort's going to have to come from that side at first.
Well, and I don't disagree with you at all. And I think that it's one area in the conservative agenda, those of us who value the American experiment, there is a lot of organization on the right. There's a lot of great resources in judicial activism and pleading the case in those channels. And we have the law on our side here. My only hesitation is that I've never seen a situation where the culture's gone against us, but the law is for us, and it all works out okay. You can get legal battles here and there to stop the bleeding, but I think the substantive and transformative victories we want that are optimal for productivity, optimal for justice, optimal for economic growth, I think ultimately the culture would have to change. And I agree it's a long ways away. And along the way, you want legal wins to not allow this thing to get totally, completely out of hand if it hasn't already. But when you say you don't have optimism about a CEO being that kind of courageous person, and I agree, Elon Musk has the ability to kind of say some things and not care what people think, but ultimately for very large public companies, it sounds like you're of the opinion that the CEOs are held hostage by their board. Because when you say the market, I'm not convinced it's the consumer. Now, I agree with Nike that their consumer liked woke. They liked Colin Kaepernick. There was a certain, Nike knew what they were doing to go down that path and generate some sort of consumer loyalty that they could monetize around the kind of social justice message and anti-patriotic, anti-police, anti-American propaganda that was at the center of that controversy. But I don't think that Delta Airlines or Coca-Cola are appeasing customers. There's something embedded in the power structure of the companies that leads the CEOs to believe that their self-preservation is better off by playing into wokeism and HR departments and DEI manuals and bureaucracy and all the things you and I have been talking about. And if the problem is boards, then do we need to go see board transformation as well? I mean, I'm trying to think of multiple fronts we engage this battle on.
First, I couldn't agree with you more that the consumer is not on the side of what's happening. Poll after poll shows that a majority of Americans, including a majority of Hispanics, Asians, and a small majority of Blacks, oppose the use of race in hiring and promotion and college admissions decisions. That is not what you would think by looking at all these programs or the people we see on television or read. They do not represent the silent majority. The problem is the power structure. Academic, media, government bureaucrats, not necessarily government elected officials, are on one side of this issue. And those people have my incredible respect for their foresight and tenacity in taking over the power structure apparatus over the last 20 years to implement an interlocking set of rules and preferences that make them so hard to dislodge. But the culture, if we mean the average American of any race, of either gender, doesn't agree with what's being done. That is the strength that we have to rely on to make things right again, to go back to sanity, and to really fight for an America in which we don't discriminate on the basis of race, ethnicity, sex, or sexual identity. I know what the polls say. The polls say that Americans favor that. The polls say Americans favor affirmative action as an outreach, as in the earlier versions, but not making decisions the way they're now being made. Boards are a problem, but boards are a problem because CalPERS is a problem. Institutional investors are a problem. Blackstone is a problem. Blackstone.
I think you mean BlackRock.
I'm sorry. I don't know why I said Blackstone. I do.
It's a Freudian slip that I have to correct almost every day.
Yes. BlackRock is a problem. When the country's largest investors announce that they're making their decisions based on environmental and social factors, everything from green to DEI, instead of profit factors, it correctly influences boards who do have to serve their investors. So this is a fundamental problem, not in the wide culture, but in the power culture.
And so there's some vicious cycles at play where, one may believe that it's best for the company. Look, they have to access capital, and if capital markets are going to cut them off, then we have to play along. And why would capital be cut off? Do the people at Wall Street really believe these things are a problem? Or are they afraid of Congress? Or are they afraid of the media? In other words, who at the end of the day is really driving it? Because everyone in the supply chain of cultural Marxism, everyone I talk to is blaming it on someone else. Like the boards, the CEOs have to be this way because of the board. The board has to be this way because of their capital providers. The capital providers have to be this way because of some other entity. Who is the real ideologue here? Okay. Because first, I don't believe that everyone in the supply chain is ideological.
First, I think the capital providers are ideologues. I don't think they have to be this way because of anything other than they choose to be this way. Second, those capital providers like
CalPERS. I'm sorry to interrupt, but that's a great point. So the Larry Finks and Black Rocks, you think are real ideologues.
Yes.
But they can't possibly, in our country right now, have a monopoly on capital allocation. I know they run trillions of dollars of ETFs, but they can't stop private equity. They can't stop private credit. They can't stop direct lending, middle markets, big tier investment banking, venture capital. We have widely sophisticated and diversified capital markets in a desperate, insatiable search for its most resourceful, efficient allocation of capital. And it seems to me that if that's where one of the ideological holes is, that we have a great way we can compete around it.
I agree with that. I do think that there are ideologues in a lot of the state pension funds and the teacher pension funds, which are very large. And put together, that's a very large ideologue set. Second, a lot of young graduates are ideologues. There is a pandering to young employees at many of these companies. Third, I think the people who run the tech companies are ideologues, and their ability to shut down dissent is real. Last, because so many of the corporate executives are Ivy League graduates, and because the Ivy League schools are run by ideologues, there is a sense of not wanting to be shunned by one's alma mater. All of my degrees, I have 3 degrees, they're all from Columbia. Columbia has become an immensely ideological school. The president of Columbia, who's been the president for 15 or 20 years, was the president of the University of Michigan during all those affirmative action cases. He firmly believes in it. The emails and letters I receive from Columbia are all about their marvelous DEI programs are nonstop. The graduates of that school and their influence in corporations are significant. On critical race theory started at Harvard Law, but today it's three major proponents for three law professors at Columbia. And Columbia is so proud of those three law professors who I think are propagating discrimination. As Ibrahim Kendi said, who's not a Columbia law professor, but he is a person who's been honest about what he wants to see happen. And he has said he wants to see discrimination against white males to rectify past discrimination. That people can speak openly that way shows how safe and secure they feel in their own elite power circles. Come back to what you said. Many, many private equity funds, family offices are run by people who share your views and mine, and not the views of the people running CalPERS. They don't want to speak up. What they may be doing is investing without regard to DEI or green or whatever else is the flavor of the month. But that's not the same thing as speaking up against companies that are practicing these offensive DEI methods. That is why corporations maybe aren't moving even faster. That is why corporations in lower profile industries maybe pay more lip service to this than they do in practical effect. But what we need, which is so difficult since the power elite control media and social media, is for those large number of investors who control a lot of capital not to just proceed quietly, but proceed noisily. I don't know how soon that's going to happen.
Well, it sounds to me like the motivation that we have at National Review, my life's mission in pursuit of a free and virtuous society, and my belief that free enterprise and capital markets are necessarily connected, it sounds to me like you're suggesting I'm on the right track here, because if we give up on capital markets, there are ideologues who will use it to their ideological agenda and will weaponize financial markets in pursuit of codified discrimination, that is DEI, quota-based hiring. They will use it in pursuit of what I consider to be a radical sexual agenda. They will use it in pursuit of what I consider to be, and you have made the compelling case for, a non-productive economic outcome. So it sounds like the legal side has to continue fighting, but financial markets need to be emboldened as well to provide, if nothing else, democratic alternatives to the insanity of CalPERS and BlackRock.
what you're doing is critical, and what you're doing is the exception. It's someone with your views willing to speak up and out and take whatever attacks you may get. As I said before, I think your views and my views are held by a lot of people. And quietly, they go about their investing and their business activities trying to ignore DEI and trying to ignore things they think are wrong or don't care about. They're reluctant, though, to speak up. So instead of having a dialogue, a debate, only one side's debating. Only one side is being heard, and the other side is being shut down. So it's through podcasts like this, it's through the rest of the work you're doing at National Review, that perhaps some of those who share, I'll say your views, which are mine, will see that they can survive publicly opposing what really doesn't make a lot of sense. And in the end, doesn't achieve objectives for Blacks and other marginalized minorities that would be achieved by improving their access to education, that would be achieved by having more tests and figuring out why they're not doing well on the tests and addressing those issues so that maybe 20 years from now, the numbers are different, not because of DEI and affirmative action, but because we've actually fixed what's not working.
Well, imagine that. Fixing what's not working. Ken, and I can talk to you about this all day, and in fact, I do want to talk to you more. I think that this subject is a work in progress and appreciate your leadership and expertise here, but would love to invite you back to Capitol Record another time so we can continue this conversation.
I'd love to. Thanks very much for having me, David.
Thank you for being with us here on Capitol Record. Well, once again, I found myself having to cut it off before I really wanted to cut it off. We could have continued going and going there. A few things he said really stuck out to me. I agree entirely that these things are going to hurt capital formation in our startups, and that is not something we can tolerate. Our defense of free enterprise must defend our most important asset, which is human capital. Having a poor allocation of resources, like all the bureaucracy and just mindless silliness that goes into these things, I agree with him. $4 billion is not a big number in GDP. But what Ken and I both are moved by is the expense that you don't necessarily see in a direct line item in the P&L. The expense that goes into so much subpar, suboptimal allocation of human capital, and that so much of this does have its origins in an immoral and illegal educational philosophy that is not embracing one of the great opportunities of our time, which is school choice to help even a lot of the playing field and provide better market-oriented solutions for educational and professional and economic opportunity, but ultimately is not only avoiding what can do great good, but is adding to what does great harm with this advent of racially driven and admissions policies that are leading to hiring policies, and not only just hiring policies, but as anyone who's paying attention knows, so much insanity on the other side. Stultifying robust activity out of corporate America. We deserve better, we need better, we want better, and here at Capitol Record, we're going to do better. Thank you for listening to National Review's Capitol Record. Send this message far and wide. We look forward to joining you next week.